Well, good morning, 3CI and our friends at Freedom Church and anyone else joining us today. I'm so excited for this next leg of the journey through the first 133 chapters of the New Testament. And it's just so lovely to be connecting with you again from this side of the planet. We've been in England now for 4.5 months. It's not actually a very long time, and we are still definitely experiencing some culture shock. The definition of culture shock is this: the feeling of disorientation experienced by someone when they are suddenly subjected to an unfamiliar culture, way of life, or set of attitudes. And you'd think we wouldn't experience much culture shock here in England, because they also drive on the correct side of the road like we do in South Africa. We've watched The Crown, we understand how that whole thing works. And everything's in English, right? And yet, I make mistakes every day. I use the wrong word in the wrong context. I ask the wrong questions. Occasionally, I drive in bus lanes. And perhaps you've experienced something like this in your life. You know, when you get to a door and you push the door and then you see the sign says pull, and you're like, oh, obs, I was supposed to pull, and you kind of really hope that nobody saw you and you feel kind of silly. I feel like I'm doing that all the time, but even the signs that say push and pull are in another language, because this whole new foreign system or situation is unfamiliar and disorienting. In grocery stores, same thing. The Bovril is not with the Marmite where everyone knows it should be. It's with the stock cubes in like the gravy aisle. And I feel like I'm looking for Bovril in every area of life. So I feel disoriented because I'm suddenly subjected to an unfamiliar culture, a different set of attitudes, a different way of life, culture shock. And maybe you've felt like this at some point in your life, maybe when you moved from school to university, maybe when you started in a new job, perhaps the first few months of marriage or parenthood felt like a culture shock to you. You felt disoriented. You didn't know quite what to do with this whole new way of life you'd been thrust into. And it's not a stretch to say that we are all experiencing some culture shock right now, because this pandemic has necessitated a whole new global system of living. And I'm aware that so many of you right now are catastrophically affected by the third wave. If you've been following along in our 133 readings, you'll know that we've been in the second half of the Gospel of Mark this week. And it's here that we see another kind of culture shock. It's like Mark's going, just look at Jesus. Watch him flip the script properly. It's like nothing you would expect. The crowds following Jesus, his closest friends, the disciples, and the Jewish leaders, they're all confronted with a dizzying new culture, the kingdom culture that Jesus came to birth. And they don't quite know what to do with it. They're suddenly subjected to an unfamiliar way of life, a radically different set of attitudes, culture shock. Everything Jesus says and does and predicts is not what the crowds or his closest friends presume it should be. They're pushing and he says, oh no, I want you to pull. The disciples keep on thinking one thing and Jesus has to say to them again and again, no, you read that wrong. It's not what you think. That's not really how God's kingdom culture works. The kingdom always moves in an opposite spirit to the world. It pulls when the world pushes. It's always upside down to the world's way of seeing things and doing things. So as we sweep through this gospel before heading into Luke, I'd love to just explore five of these kingdom culture shock moments, and there are many, and I'm asking God to use this to put courage in us. So five instances where the world's culture that the disciples and others are leaning into is juxtaposed with the kingdom culture that Jesus is displaying for them. And then, well, what does this mean for us in 2021, a strange, difficult, uncertain, unprecedented time in history? As part of the local church and the global church, how do we align ourselves with kingdom culture and find our security and stability there? Okay, so the first culture shock that Jesus' disciples need to adjust to is that Jesus comes to bring not a coup d'etat, but a coup de grace. So you see, in this first century Jewish world, the idea of a Messiah, what the Jews, including the disciples, had their hopes set on, was a victorious military leader who would triumphantly rescue them from Roman tyranny. I mean, I would definitely have wanted that. I could totally see myself getting behind the vision of a rebellion or a coup. Just feels so exciting. Like, yes, you know, let's get rid of the current dispensation who have done nothing but persecute and harass us, and let's get behind a hero who can dominate and liberate. But Jesus didn't stage a coup d'etat. He staged a coup de grace. A coup de grace is the final shot or blow given to a wounded person or animal. It's the merciful death blow for the sake of setting that person free from pain. Except Jesus surrendered himself to the coup de grace. God administered the death blow, and the mercy was poured out on us. That decisive, shocking act of grace was for our benefit, to set us free from the pain of our pasts. We saw in Matthew 16, we see here in Mark chapter 8, Peter is happy to proclaim that Jesus is the Messiah, but then he reprimands Jesus, Mark 8, 32, for predicting his own death. He says, oh, no, that's not the plan. You're not supposed to die. You're supposed to move into the government buildings, overthrow the oppressors, and wave a new flag. And Jesus says, it's not what you think. He was building a new culture, and he was laying the foundations with his own life, which he gave away for us. The second culture shock that confronts the disciples is something we might call fame versus the freedom of self-forgetfulness. Fame versus the freedom of self-forgetfulness. Matt pointed out to me the other day in a voice note, thank you, Matt, that in this section of Mark, Jesus predicts his death three times. And every time he does, the disciples follow up with, okay, cool, can I sit next to you in heaven? You know, or they argue amongst themselves going, you know, I'm the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. No, I'm the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, and you're not invited to my birthday party. Jesus is trying to explain to them the shocking upside down kingdom culture that he's creating, and they just don't get it. They go, okay, sure, but surely the Marmite is next to the Bovril. And we're quick to criticize the disciples and go like, wow, they were just like so immature in their faith. But we do this so easily. We are so easily caught up in the world's ways, which promise that rubbing shoulders with the leader, the man or the woman of the moment, will bring status and fame and invitations to all the right birthday parties. Kingdom culture says rubbing shoulders with the leader, Jesus, will result in dying to yourself, happy to let others blow out all your birthday candles and open your presents, forgetting yourself, and in that, entering into an incredible new freedom. Tim Keller has a superb, really short audiobook called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, and I would so highly recommend it. But he says something along the lines of this, and this is not a direct quote, it's just what I wrote in my journal. But he says, basically, to be truly free from conceit and contempt and all other ego-driven ugliness, we need to take on Paul's mindset, which was, I don't care what you think of me. Equally, I don't care what I think of me. I care what God thinks of me. He has gone to court over my identity. The verdict has been passed. The court is adjourned. He has declared me innocent with songs of celebration and love. When we truly believe that, it will change our thoughts and feelings, our actions and attitudes. We won't be so easily offended. We'll have far more grace and compassion for others. We'll be interested in their lives and we'll wish them well. We'll have nothing to offer but kindness because we won't be constantly trying to protect our sensitive selves. I mustn't be fooled into thinking I only have to believe it once. I need to preach this gospel truth to myself several times a day. So the Jesus culture says, forget fame. In fact, forget yourself. There's a third world versus kingdom culture shock moment. Let's call it bodyguards versus beggars. In Mark 10, from verse 46, we read this. Then they reached Jericho, and as Jesus and his disciples left town, a large crowd followed him. A blind beggar named Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, was sitting beside the road. When Bartimaeus heard that Jesus of Nazareth was nearby, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Be quiet, many of the people yelled at him, but he only shouted louder, son of David, have mercy on me. When Jesus heard him, he stopped and said, "Tell him to come here." So they called the blind man. "Cheer up," they said. "Come on, he's calling you." One version says, "Cheer up, get up, he's calling you." And I love that. I kind of think we all need to say that to ourselves when we wake up every morning and we'd rather stay under the duvet. Cheer up, get up, he's calling you into this new day. Bartimaeus threw aside his coat, jumped up, and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked. "My rabbi," the blind man said, "I want to see." And Jesus said to him, "Go, for your faith has healed you." Instantly, the man could see, and he followed Jesus down the road. If worldly culture had been directing this scene, the leader wouldn't have had time for the beggar outside the arena. In fact, the main guy, the one the crowds have come to see, he wouldn't even have seen or heard the beggar, never mind stopped, because he would have been chauffeured through a private entrance and his bodyguards and bouncers would have ushered him straight to the green room. Not Jesus, because that's not the kingdom culture he came to build. Jesus stops and he calls for Bartimaeus. He's looking for faith. He's looking for the least of these, like Steve pointed out a couple weeks ago. People are yelling at Bartimaeus to shut up, and Jesus says, "Whoa, this whole situation and how you're reading it, it's not what you think. Watch me turn it upside down." And Jesus loves on Bartimaeus, and he heals him, and he is set free to follow Jesus. The fourth cultural contrast, world versus kingdom, that we see is something we might call after versus before. After versus before. If the world's culture had a gift shop selling souvenirs, there would be key rings and t-shirts and caps and, you know, saying things like entitled and what's in it for me. And I think if we're honest, we all feel the tug of Western culture, which demands that we wait for something really great to happen, and then afterwards we might say thank you, but only in the sense that we really expected something great to happen for us because, well, we deserved it. You know, so it's first, okay, show me what you've got for me, and then, yeah, all right, thanks. In the culture of the kingdom that Jesus is demonstrating, he turns that upside down. He gives thanks before something really great happens. His thanksgiving precedes the miracle. He gives thanks before the miracle takes place. Have a look at Mark chapter 8. Jesus is about to supernaturally feed thousands of people once again, just like he did in chapter 6. It's another moment for him to delight in miracles. He's going, whoa, not enough food, fantastic. Let's pray and then feed loads of people. So Mark 8 from verse 1. About this time, another large crowd had gathered, and the people ran out of food again. Jesus called his disciples and told them, "I feel sorry for these people. They have been here with me for 3 days, and they have nothing left to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will faint along the way, for some of them have come a long distance." His disciples replied, "How are we supposed to find enough food to feed them out here in the wilderness?" Even though they've just seen him do it, like two chapters ago, right? Jesus asked, "How much bread do you have?" "Seven loaves," they replied. So Jesus told all the people to sit down on the ground. Then he took the seven loaves, thanked God for them, and broke them into pieces. He gave them to his disciples, who distributed the bread to the crowd. A few small fish were found too, so Jesus also blessed these and told the disciples to distribute them. They ate as much as they wanted. Afterward, the disciples picked up seven large baskets of leftover food. There were about 4,000 men in the crowd that day. Matthew tells this same story and adds, not to mention all the women and children. We have a teenage boy living in our house now, and so we like literally run out of bread about every 3 hours. So there must have been a ton of food here. And Jesus sent them home after they had eaten. What Jesus is teaching his disciples here is not a kind of name it and claim it, rub the lamp three times and make a wish theology. He simply thanked his Father for the bread, the loaves that they had in their hands. But he's saying it's not what you think. It might not make sense to you, but gratitude ushers in miracles. So instead of waiting for God to tick a bunch of things off our lists before we say, okay, cool, thanks very much, Jesus is inviting us to just draw near and begin to offer sacrifices of thanks for what he has already given us, what he has already done for us. And then rest in the truth that he knows what we need. You know, it's just seek first his kingdom. It's that principle. And then all these things will be added unto you in his time, his way. But there's even more to this story about the feeding of the multitudes. And our fifth worldly culture versus kingdom culture moment is something we might call self-preservation versus sowing. Self-preservation versus sowing. So first, just huge disclaimer in flashing red letters. Self-preservation is not the same as looking after yourself and taking time to rest and refresh and restore your energy so that you can be as effective as possible in all your spheres of influence, right? If you've lost all sense of where you stop and other people start, and as a result they are walking all over your emotional life, you need to draw a line. We need to develop healthy boundaries, all of us. Jesus had healthy boundaries, regularly heading off alone to rest and pray. So if you've been running on empty for far too long and you're pretty much the worst version of yourself right now, pull over before you cause an accident. Okay, so that's not what we're talking about when we talk about a worldly culture of self-preservation. What we're talking about is selfishness. Okay, we're talking about looking for the biggest rusk in the jar instead of perhaps leaving it for someone else in the family. Okay, like this is an enormous struggle for me every morning. I really want the biggest rusk. You know, it's like when there are two of you in the spiraling plane and one parachute. It's what Andy was talking about last week, you know, saying that humans haven't evolved to become better and better, and now we're all just flawlessly magnanimous. No, we all still want the parachute and the biggest rusk. And we can dress those things up and say, oh, it's part of our natural instinct as humans to survive, and I'm sure there's some truth in that. But I think if we're really honest, and if we really ask the Holy Spirit to shine a light on our hearts, I think we all know how selfish we can be. You know, it's the disciples going like, yeah, we're all so hungry and tired. Like, don't make their problem our problem. Where are we supposed to find enough food for everyone? Because actually we can't even deal right now. And Jesus shows them and us a better way. He says, well, what have you got there? Just bring it, because I'm God. Instead of closing his fists in self-preservation, he opens his hands and he begins to sow. Have a look at Proverbs 11:25. It says, the generous will prosper. Those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed. It's the strange upside down kingdom principle that, you know, when you feel you have nothing to give and you badly need some refreshing yourself, you offer it to others, and you see how God turns that into refreshment for your soul. I mean, I'm guessing Jesus, like the crowds and his disciples, he's also hungry and tired after three straight days of preaching. So he feeds others. He meets the needs of others. He refreshes others. I mean, guys, just imagine the wells of refreshing that would spring up across our cities and communities if we all committed to doing this for 1 month, or I don't know, you know, forever. When you would so desperately love for someone to reach out to you and ask if you're okay, when you'd really love someone to give you a call or a WhatsApp and just encourage you and put some wind in your sails, what if instead you picked up your phone and you did the calling and the texting? What if you pray on the way to the office hand sanitizing station or the Zoom meeting or the school car park, wherever you find your feet? What if you ask God to give you words of life and wisdom for the people you will encounter? What if you decide to ask them about themselves, like just show an interest, right? Let them tell their stories and then offer gentle, encouraging words of refreshing. Refresh someone else and you will be refreshed. It doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive. The Bovril really should be right next to the Marmite, but somehow it brings life. It's kingdom culture. And we find this principle of kingdom culture throughout scripture. In Genesis 26, a severe famine strikes the land. God gives Isaac some instructions. He plants seeds and harvests 100 times more grain than he planted in a time of famine. There's some conflict with the people around because jealousy makes you nasty, and they fill up his wells with dirt, and a whole lot of stuff goes down. But ultimately, Isaac digs another well and he calls it Rehoboth, which means open space. It doesn't make sense to sow in a time of famine. It definitely doesn't make sense to then reap 100-fold and to be brought into a spacious place. But that's kingdom culture. We've said this so many times over the last year, but it doesn't make sense to build a church in the midst of a global pandemic. But that's kingdom culture. You know, maybe it doesn't make sense to resign and take the job offering less money, except maybe you've got faith for it because you're building kingdom culture. You've got faith to earn less money in a job that allows you to practice your profession ethically and with integrity because, well, God is your provider and he will not be mocked. And if he is who he says he is, then you will reap. Maybe not financially, but somehow. And you will be led into a spacious place because that's kingdom culture. Psalm 126, verse 5 and 6 say, "Those who plant in tears will harvest with shouts of joy. They weep as they go out to plant their seed, but they sing as they return with the harvest. Those who plant with seven loaves and a few fish will harvest with seven large baskets of leftovers." It's in giving ourselves away, like Jesus did, that we reap a harvest of refreshing. So 3CI, Freedom Church, friends watching online, current circumstances mean we're all experiencing to some extent the disorientation of being suddenly subjected to an unfamiliar way of life and set of attitudes. And I get the sense that in our panic, sometimes we're pushing and we should be pulling, or we're pulling and we should be pushing. And Jesus says, "My yoke is easy, my burden is light. I came to bring not just an existence, but abundant life." You know, that's the culture of the kingdom. And that means, you know, whatever is lacking around us, like Marmite again, I believe in South Africa, because the lockdown alcohol bans have disrupted the supply of brewer's yeast from beer makers, which is the byproduct from which Marmite is made. But no matter what is lacking around us, politically, financially, relationally, Jesus has staged a coup de grace. And we can lean into that culture. And guys, let's keep speaking this truth. Let's keep casting this cultural vision for one another. We are living in a dispensation of God's grace. And God's grace is enough. That's not a cliche. It's just true. When you reach the end of yourself and all the things, and many of you have, you'll find that Jesus is still there. And he's enough. And it's from that grace space that he invites us into the freedom of "it's not about me." And suddenly we have more energy and more creativity because we're not exhausted from the hustle. And we begin to notice the beggars and the bodyguards and everyone in between, all the people around us who desperately need the enoughness of Jesus. Kingdom culture calls us to give thanks today for what God has already done for us, for what is already in our hands, before he does another good thing, before he gives us anything else, and then trust him for the provision and the protection and the promotion that he knows you need. So let's keep sowing, even in times of famine. Let's keep on refreshing others so that we ourselves might be refreshed. And maybe someone's come to mind, even as you've been listening today, someone whom you know needs refreshing. Can I just ask, please, please reach out to them and then enjoy the bonus byproduct of refreshing that you will receive. It'll be like making beer and Marmite. Friends, it's a weird time in the world. It's a frightening time for many of us personally, but take heart. This is not the end of the story. There is a beautiful new building at number 56 Saul Street. It is finished, but we are not finished. We are still very much under construction, and we get to keep on building this counterintuitive, radical culture of the kingdom that shocks the world in the best and most beautiful ways and keeps us free. God bless you.